This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. My name is Rich Bradbury. This, of course, is Enterprise BizBytes. I'm joined in the studio today by...
Jeff Sandhu.
Arvind Yuvaraj.
It's been a while since the three of us have been together in a small room.
It has.
Yeah?
Yeah, wow, okay. I really had no idea we were going to go down that route, but yeah, thanks for bringing back some really unpleasant memories.
I did notice, though, on today, my Facebook showed me today that today, Jeff, yes. It is our eight-year friendiversary.
I know, such a big day.
Yeah. Yeah. And the ironic thing is, half of the pictures that it's supposed to show us of me and you together, we're not even in it.
So I'm like the third wheel here.
Yeah, you're the third wheel here. Okay. It's been a long romance, Arv.
Yeah, Arv, you could get in touch with us via Twitter and WhatsApp as well to be part of this conversation.
Okay, you can get us on WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. Of course, get us on Twitter. We are at BFM Radio. Stories we've got lined up today. We've got a story about how Uganda are charging people to use social media. That's one of the stories that we're kicking off with. How Kazakhstan are throttling the internet when the president's rival is online. Mm. I'm wondering where they got that story from. Mm. Then we'll be talking a little bit about the banking back end. That's something that Jeff's explored. Yeah. A device that will literally tell you how much you stink. I bet you can't guess whose story that is. And story number five, in the future, fingerprint sensors will take your temperature to prove that you're human. But before that, Jeff has something about going cashless.
No, yeah, so I came into office today and Visa, the credit card payment solutions provider, right? So they sent a study over to my email address. And I just got back from Sweden where I realized how cashless society they are because, you know, I changed quite a big sum of ringgit to Swedish krona. And I actually came back with more than 80% of it because they are very much in a cashless society.
Right.
And I then got this study, which is quite timely in the sense that Visa... the 2017 Visa Consumer Payment Attitude Study showed that Malaysians are increasingly confident in going cashless with 6 in 10 saying that they could go without cash for the entire day, and close to half of them, about 41%, saying that they could at least do 3 days without cash. But Arv, you know what happened this morning when I got into office and I met one of our fellow colleagues who's also in the studio with us today?
Tell me.
So Richard came into the office and the first thing he said to me is like, Jeff, could you lend me 50, please? I left my wallet at home.
Oh, that's a different kind of cashless.
It's an entirely different.
I guess he wasn't part of this survey this would really throw out, you know. What do you have to say for yourself?
First, in my defense, you say here, Malaysians are increasingly confident of going cashless. I'm not Malaysian.
All right, okay.
First and foremost.
Saved.
But normally, I'm very much in that habit of carrying my wallet around with me. And I try to limit the amount of cash that I actually have in it.
Yes.
And I am using my card an awful lot more. Because I don't like having change in my pocket. I don't like having small notes in my wallet. Mm-hmm. If I could, I would... for the majority, use my card to pay for whatever I can.
You know, interestingly, Jermaine, our events committee manager as well, right? So she goes on really without cash for days. Because every time when we go out to get lunch and stuff, she would always just, you know, ask someone else to get her lunch, to tapau the food for her, right? And then she would have problems in paying that person back, and she'll just ask for the bank account details of the individual, like, I'll transfer 8 ringgit or 12 ringgit to you, or doing, you know, your online transfer thingy, right? Mm-hmm. And then I asked her, just today I was just asking, it's like, so how do you go about your daily lives without any cash at whatsoever? She's like, I don't even have 10 ringgit in my wallet. So how do you do it? And it's like, I don't need. It's like, you don't pay for anything? It's like, no, when I drive, if I need to pump petrol, I use my card. And I use Smart Tax for my toll.
Yeah.
For any places that I need to park, I use Touch and Go.
Yeah.
In the office, I have the monthly card. Mm-hmm. Anywhere else, I could just use my debit cards or credit cards.
I have a friend exactly the same. All they take out with them when they go out is their phone and their bank card. That's it.
I don't know. I'm still not very comfortable in having zero cash in my wallet. Like, I'm just, I would at least need a 20 or a 50, at least, a bare minimum.
It's that backup plan, right?
Yeah, because, you know, you never know when Richard's just going to come up to you and go like, hey, could you lend me a 50? I left my wallet back.
But
home,
you see,
right?
The reason I came to you is that I knew you'd have cash, you know, because
you're
not because you're wealthy, sadly, but because you're one of these other people like me that likes to have a little bit of cash.
Yeah, just feeling that comfortableness, right?
Can you top up touch and goes with online banking, like CIMB Clicks or Maybank to You?
I believe that you can, yes.
They have also tried, you know, having their new systems where you could now top up using an online portal and stuff, but they have a lot of hiccups on that. So, yeah.
See, because that's the only reason I have cash, because I'm always worried that I'll go to the toll and then I won't have enough in touch and go, so I need cash to top up.
Yes. Yeah. So that's one of the true.
It's not the only reason. One of the biggest reasons that I carry cash with me, because I don't know if I can do the top ups using my phone.
Good question, though. Yeah. Carry on.
Probably. I guess we should just ask people, like, you know, how much.
How cashless are you?
Yeah, how cashless are you? Also, contactless payments, according to the study, the contactless payment awareness in Malaysia has also increased to about 87% in 2017. And about 2 in 3 Malaysians now say that they would choose contactless payments over cash if it's widely available. And this is obviously like your Visa PayWave and stuff. And I love it. I really prefer Visa PayWave.
Agreed.
You just don't have to key in your PIN and, you know, you have to sign all those kind of things, right?
But there's also a limit for...
It's no more than 250. Anything 250. Below 250, but... Like, yeah, if you're buying anything that more than 250, you may want to just have a bit more of protection. You need to, you know, put in your PIN number sign the thing, right? But yeah.
Let us know, folks. How cashless are you? Get us via WhatsApp, 018-789-8899, or get us on Twitter at BFM Radio. Again, 018-789-8899. I'll quickly throw this story out, Jeff, before you move on to the Kazakhstan story, about how Uganda Ugandans who use social media apps on their mobile phones, like Facebook, WhatsApp, Twitter, Instagram, or Skype, must now pay a small fee per day. Can you get this? So the government hopes to generate $360 million, that's around 1.45 billion ringgit per year, representing about 4% of the annual state spending. Critics are seeing this tax as an attempt by the president to make life more difficult for his opponents. This sounds very familiar. The president is an active Twitter user who's been in power since 86. He's blaming social media for the spread of rumors and gossip. That's what happens when you're an active Twitter user and a president. Sound familiar?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In so many ways.
Bigliest. Mm. During the 2016 general election, the opposition, the government shut down the mobile internet to make it difficult for the opposition to organize protests. Again, some bells are ringing in my head. So starting on Sunday, every Ugandan who uses social media via mobile internet has to pay 200 shillings a day, which is 20 sen per day. Phone companies will be collecting the tax for the state. So the tax would amount to around $18 per year on average, about 3% of annual per capita income in the East African country. So of Uganda's 40 million people, about 17 million have access to the internet via their mobiles. Now, how would you feel about this? You know, having to pay to use Twitter, would that kind of curtail, do you think, the amount that you used it?
It's
20 cent a day.
I don't think it's fair, though.
Right.
To be honest with you.
Nor do I.
I would protest if it's that. Like, because you already pay for your provider itself, right? To use data connections to get onto the internet, and the internet then provides you with services. Some services you have to pay, you know, like you do your news outlets and stuff that you need to have a paywall that you have, right? So you already pay for certain services, and then those services that you don't pay, you are the product itself, right? So yeah, like, why do I have to pay an additional thing to the government in that sense to be able to use services like that?
We're looking at this and then we think that it sounds like bad that Uganda's doing this to its users and stuff, but then isn't this the same thing that they want to do in the US if the net neutrality thing so if that goes through, or they don't have net neutrality anymore, then those providers can charge for social media websites or any website that you want to
correct
use.
Exactly.
So it's almost the same thing, just in different contexts.
Except in the American context, it would be the providers that would claim the tax, whereas in Uganda, it's the government who would claim the tax from the providers.
So it's still going up to the same government.
At the end of
just
the day.
Just through different channels.
Right? Yeah. Oof. Net neutrality.
Let's shift on to story number two, before we take a break, about how Kazakhstan is throttling the internet when the president's rival is online.
So, you know, every evening for the past 4 months, social media websites have become largely unusable for many people in Kazakhstan. You know, after a hard day of work, you probably, you know, go back home for a couple of hours and you want to just go on to sites like Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, even messaging apps like Telegram. They all either now don't work at all or they just work really slowly. And this is also apparently a big problem right now because it's World Cup season. So a lot of people in Kazakhstan say that they actually can't talk to their friends about the World Cup because a lot of these services are now just completely, you know, unusable at all, right? So the trouble appears to have started around March when the court in capital, Astana, deemed the opposition group, the Democratic Choice of Kazakhstan, or DVK in its Russian initials, it's an extremist organization. So DVK, which was set up by a self-exiled government for Mukhtar Abilazov, he appears to have only a very marginal following, but he has used online resources to spread his word. And now he's aping the internet savvy strategy of Russian opposition figures like Alexei Navalny. Abilazov has taken to delivering his political homilies through live video on Facebook, and it's often done in the evening. So the Astana court extremist ruling has in effect criminalized the sharing of any of the movement's publicly materials. Now, the choking of the internet connection each evening is another sort of like prong on the anti-DVK front. And the government actually freely admits this. And in April, an IT system operator called Andrei Saviev, he posted a plaintive plea to the information ministry asking why are some of these websites performing so dismal, you know, very horribly. And also he's saying that, you know, people are actually losing a major outlet for their leisure time.
For sure.
Now, the criticism of government policy is just not a very commonplace in Kazakhstan, but this internet restriction, they've sort of generated a very unusual levels of ill will. People are getting really annoyed about this, but most of them actually aren't DVK supporters. They're just regular folks, right? And they probably, some of them are even not interested in politics at all. But now they're just standing up and taking notice of this and go like, why can't I now go onto YouTube and Facebook and Twitter? And then they're getting agitated with the current government because of something like this.
See, this all sounds very familiar, right?
Yeah, it does.
There's a bunch of Malaysians listening right now who are going, how is this
nodding
news?
Their head.
How is this news?
This, you know, this is nodding their head.
We've dealt with this for however many years.
You know, a political analyst, Ruslan Zagayev, he said that the government is just simply overestimating Abilazov's influence. He said, you know, the scale of countermeasures that's being adopted to neutralize DVK is only having the effect of amplifying their relevance and also their status. And in any case, those who are determined to view this this materials that are illegal and also to just overcome these restrictions, popular sites like YouTube and stuff, they're actually able to do so very easily. They just have to get a VPN.
VPN, yeah.
Or just get another browser, one of those Tor browsers, and then it solves the problem.
Right.
It's that simple. So, like, again, it's the problem that they're trying to do, what they're trying to curb here, which is the extremist group trying to gain popularity, which actually doesn't even have any popularity or any following, according to the people in Kazakhstan itself, the political analysts in Kazakhstan saying that it's very few. But because of something that has been done now in restricting the internet because of the fear that it may grow bigger, it has caused an upset on people who were probably not even interested in politics, now saying like, hey guys, like, why is this happening? Why is my internet being restricted?
And what that does is, because these people were not originally interested in politics, but when you take away their entertainment, their YouTube and one thing or another,
it's World Cup season.
They suddenly get very interested in politics, and we've seen what can happen when those group of people are marginalized like that, right?
So I'm thinking, it sounds familiar, one, before, like, you know, before the last 2 months, for us it sounds super familiar, but it also sounds like years and years ago when they had the communist curfews. So that was happening, like, physically, when, you know, we're trying to curb, like, the communist movements and stuff, and now it's so weird that it's now completely digital. Mm. Like all these movements are just happening online, and they're doing like the same kind of curfews and blocking and, you know, sort of like choking their movements and stuff. It's a weird situation.
You're right.
Yeah. The irony of this situation is that the Information Ministry in Kazakhstan, which is behind the internet blockages, was created in 2016 with the express aim of ensuring smooth provision of information to Kazakhstan citizens. So,
Funny that.
Poor chaps, though. But yeah, like, you know, this is like kind of like a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, you got to do things to curb extremists trying to get popularity. But doing a blanket rule where you're throttling the internet and stuff, that would just... Yeah, it's just not the way.
Again, though, it falls into that remit of depending on who you listen to, depends on whether or not they're an extremist group. You know, there are a lot of people who do not like the current government in Kazakhstan, and it's these people who, this is a small, like you say,
a small portion of percentage.
And it depends who you listen to as to whether or not, you know, the current president is on the right side, I guess. So. Tit for tat, I guess. Right, time to take a very short break. We've got some music coming up from U2 with Desire. However, if you listen to Arvin's story that comes up next, you might be less desirable.
Mm.
It's all about a device that literally tells you how much you stink here on Enterprise Biz Bytes. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with the show, 018-789-8899. We're asking you, how cashless are you?
Oh, well, we've got some really interesting
responses. So keep the messages coming in. We'll read them during the song, and then we'll feedback with a few of them in a few minutes. BFM 89.9.
Before Friday materializes, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm in the studio with...
Arvin Yuvraj.
Jeff Landu.
With you all the way through until 1 o'clock this afternoon. If you want to get in touch, tell us how cashless you are, and I don't mean broke. Get us on WhatsApp, 018-789-8899, or of course on Twitter at BFM Radio, like our listeners have done. We've had a bunch of messages. Take it away, Jeff.
Yeah, so Wesley sent in a WhatsApp saying that, bear in mind for petrol, if one uses a debit card or even a credit card, 200 ringgit will be held for 3 days, even if you just pump for 50 ringgit.
Really?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that happens with credit card too. Yeah. So
interesting.
It's just kind of like a secure. They secure that amount first, and then they will charge you.
Oh, I thought it's only for debit. No.
It happens with my credit card too. Maybe just my credit card.
Uh-huh. Or maybe just they're singling you out.
Maybe they're just singling out. It's like, oh, I don't trust this guy.
I've seen you. I know you're not trustworthy.
Hey, I'm the one who lend you 50 today. All right.
This is true.
I'm gonna charge you triple the amount and get it back.
Why am I not surprised? Okay, more.
Kevin says, it's durian season now, and I don't think you can go cashless if you want to get those yummy fruit into your tummy. I think the issue here is more of businesses must be able to accept cashless payment in order to go fully cashless.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is quite true, because there are some businesses who still struggle to adopt because some of them also feel like there's a little bit of capital to put out first. And also the whole process of doing their invoicing and cash flow itself is a little bit tricky as well. But some have done it really well. So
there's something about beggars in there as well.
Yeah, so there's another guy who sent in a WhatsApp message. I think his name is Haridas. He didn't mention his name, but I'm guessing that's his name, Haridas. He said that he saw in Setia Alam Night Market, they have started to use Booster, the payment channel. So imagine that, cashless in Pasar Malam. But he also said that, you know, how do you then donate to beggars on the road? So are we going to see a reduction on beggars?
Funny you should say that. Over in China currently, WeChat have got that feature. Funnily enough, you can use it they literally carry a QR code around their neck or wherever it is, and if you want to donate to the beggar, bing, there you go. Wow.
And they don't even want to accept cash.
Right.
For
the most part, they don't want it. Yeah.
You know, I actually saw that in Sweden too. The beggar didn't want to accept cash. He was in the train and just like refused to accept cash from this American tourist, and they were giving some bunch of coins, and she's like, no, and she's just pointing to her phone, and I'm like, wait, is she just trying to say like, yo, she wants this cashless thing going
maybe
on?
She just wanted the telephone number.
maybe.
Alright,
there's also one Matthew, and he says that he's all for contactless pay because he was studying in the UK and everything was really easy. You just have to just carry one card around, and there's no hassle of finding an ATM before you go to a restaurant or, you know, grocery shopping. He says that he hopes that we will see a system that is sort of fully contactless here in Malaysia as well. Also, if cards are stolen, it's just a lot easier to track since every transaction is registered with the bank.
Good point.
Whereas cash is just untraceable. Also, we can save a lot of paper by not printing out cash.
Agreed.
Yeah, so kind of leads me to, you know, I earlier had a conversation with Shankar Kanibaran. He's the partner in the financial advisory services leader in Ernst & Young. Because we all talk about online banking, we talk about electronic transfer of money and also online payments, and we kind of take it for granted because it's just like a few simple clicks. It's just like logging onto Facebook and Twitter, and then you could just send money, you can buy stuff online.
Click, click, click.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a few clicks. But how does it actually work? Like, where do you actually leave footprints behind? And if you do leave these footprints behind, who's able to sort of just follow this money trail in that sense, right? And we've all seen the news recently about how, you know, money can be moved around the world electronically within just a matter of hours or days. And then, like, what happens then? Like, how does it all work? So, yeah, I just spoke to him and I just started by asking Shankar about, like, just what are some of the types of online payments that we have at this point of time?
Okay, so when we talk about electronic payments, essentially it's to facilitate the transfer of goods or services. Mm-hmm. And essentially you are doing a payment via a digital mode or electronically. That's what essentially we look at, the space of electronic payments. And typically, the typical instruments that you tend to hear in the market would be cards, whether it be credit card, debit card, or charge cards. And in recent years, you have also seen e-wallets, e-cash. So example of e-cash would be PayPal, which you can also use, you know, you link it to your bank account or credit card, top it up, and then you use PayPal as a payment mode as well. That's also gaining wide acceptance within the space as well. And then you have mobile payments and internet banking. Of course, most of us are exposed to internet banking. We use that as a payment mode for a lot of transaction in today's world. And when we look at the types of the instruments, essentially there's three categories that we would normally have. One is what we call as open loop. These are your bank accounts via internet banking, Visa, MasterCard. And we call it open loop simply because, you know, you can use it. There's no restriction in where you can use it, as long as the buyer and the seller or the merchant and the consumer has an account, an electronic banking account. You can use the format. You can pay the transaction or pay for the goods and services via this. The second category is what we call as closed loop. For example, this would be like Starbucks card, right? Today, you can purchase Starbucks card from the outlet, but what it is it's a preloaded cash value in electronic format, and it's only accepted in Starbucks outlet. You can't use it outside of the Starbucks outlet. So that's what we call as the second category, the closed loop. And the third category is the semi-closed loop, where, you know, example would be VCash from Digi, which is a telco wallet. You can use it in some merchants. You can use it in some service providers. You can top up, you can load it, you can link it to your bank account. So that's the broadly three types of category when we talk about payment, electronic payment.
What about if I were to send money to someone or to a different bank account? How would that work?
Okay, so typically there's two, I mean, broad category would be essentially assuming both of you have account and it's a domestic, and typically domestic, it goes through between the same bank, then it goes from account A to account B, where you need to enter who's the receiver, and then the account number, the cash gets transferred. But if it goes to another bank, typically it goes through the MAPS network, where, you know, you need to provide who's the receiving bank and the account number. It goes through the MAPS network and gets routed through. The second element is international transfers, right? So typically, most banks assuming bank A in Malaysia, a customer in bank A wants to transfer to a person B in a bank in Singapore. So first, if the bank has a direct relationship, typically it goes to SWIFT network and then it gets transferred to the bank across if both banks have relationship with each other. But assuming that if it's an unknown bank, so for a third country that the bank doesn't have relationship, typically what it does, it goes to a clearing bank, and then the clearing bank that has the relationship with the other bank does the transfer as well. So this typically why in some cases when you do international transfer, the transfer could be within the same day, but some 3 to 4 days because it needs time to allow for this clearing to happen as well.
Who does these checks and balances in order to make sure that, you know, the transactions are, you know, are verified and they fit the whatever criteria that's, you know, that is requested?
So typically the sending bank and the receiving bank sends a message. I mean, the SWIFT network has the message format that's prescribed when you're trying to do international transfer, and there are information that you need to enter. The bank where you have an account will then debit your account. For example, 100 ringgit you would like to transfer to a person in Singapore, then sends the information to Bank B. Bank B then validates that, you know, the account exists, and then credits that amount into your account in into the other person's account in the other country as well. So there is a validation where there is prescribed message format that have that manages that process as well.
Do we leave footprints behind when we make transactions like this, you know, transferring money from one place to the other? Are there footprints that we leave behind?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even in the case, I mean, every transaction you perform, I mean, there would be audit trail, even to start with from the basic in your account itself as a debit action that's been performed on your account. Then for every transfer on the SWIFT network, there is also corresponding information that's recorded in both the sender and the receiving bank as well, and up to the final transaction that goes into your account. That's from one element as well. So in addition to that, if the amount exceeds a certain limit, there's also a regulatory requirement depending on each country. For example, you need to send a report to Bank Negara to say that this, for the case of Malaysia, that you know, these are the transactions that are sent across that are above certain value as well.
Who's allowed to check on these trails? Is it, you know, for Malaysia's case, is it like Bank Negara would be the one that will be able to allow to be checked on, you know, where the trails are, you know, looking at footprints of you know, money trails in that sense?
So typically when this is in a case when there's investigation and there's a request for investigation, then if it's a domestic transaction, then clearly the sender and receiver bank would need to then have to access the records and look at the transactions and provide those data. So it depends on the case-by-case basis. I mean, is it a police case or is it in an investigation by Bank Negara or MACC, for the example?
So it's never really anonymous then, you know, even though it's done electronically, it's, you know, it seems very easy. It's just, you know, keying in a few passwords and, you know, my username and password, and I could do everything online. But it's never anonymous then.
No. In fact, I think the only way you can do anonymous is cash, right? I mean, that's what traditionally everybody has been doing, and why governments around the world have been pushing the need to go into a essentially digital payments, e-payments, because the moment you push them into a cashless society where everything is digitally monitored or transacted, then you leave footprints that can be investigated, can be traced. Hence why I think a lot of countries around the world are saying that, look, go digital, use e-payments rather than using cash. Because cash, essentially, you know, you can move around without being traced.
Surprisingly, now it feels a lot more secure to do things online.
yep, definitely. I mean, there are mechanisms. I mean, even when we talk about simple things about, you know, how do you leave trace? For example, when you open your bank account, the banks typically need to do KYC process, know your customer process, in a sense that you need to provide evidence. If you're Malaysian, your IC number, your address, your phone book, phone details, and so on. So the bank needs to do certain level of checking to make sure that, you know, you are who you are, and we're opening an account for a legitimate reason. And then your transactions, again, will be monitored if it fits into pattern. So, for example, credit card transactions. Like every time you swipe your credit card, there is a monitoring rule-based engine that looks at the transaction and triggers an alert. This is more from two angles, right? One is to, you know, catch fraudulent transactions, but the other way to look at it is also a form of customer protection, right? Because assuming you're a Malaysian, you've been spending, your spending pattern average is 3,000 ringgit, suddenly you get somebody swiping a 10,000 ringgit amount transaction, a card, that should raise an alarm bell, and that triggers the bank to either call you and say that did you perform this transaction, or block that transaction and get a confirmation from you. So that those are some of the measures that banks have put in place to make sure that, you know, this has been tracked. One, to manage fraud, but second is also to make sure that, you know, you don't get instances where your card has been tampered with and it's being used for fraudulent transactions as well.
And it also helps banks to monitor, you know, fraudulent activities, money laundering, with the use of AI and big data, where they're able to sort of trace and monitor you know, movements of you know, big sums of cash if it's being moved around for illegal purposes as well.
Yes. Definitely.
Yeah, so interesting that was Shankar Kanibaran. He's the partner and the financial advisory services leader in Ernst & Young's, and talking about just how it kind of works, like how does it work when you go online and you make, you know, online payments or just transfer money from one place to the other. The takeaway from that is, one is that you always leave footprints behind. So you could always trace when it goes online. So that is a sort of a sign to see why a lot of countries are moving to you know, online or digital sort of payments or you know, cashless society, because you can trace. Because cash is very hard to trace. There's no money trail in cash. Mm-hmm. Going back to some of the question that we are asking our listeners about, you know, how do you go cashless and stuff. Tenny message and said that we can't go cashless just yet, because how are we going to buy our favorite, you know, goreng pisang and like keropok and all those irresistible sugarcane and coconut drinks, not forgetting cendol as well. Don't be cashless, because those little stalls, they ain't going to accept cards or, you know, the touch and go cards very soon for your, you know, or touch and go kue card.
That's, I disagree. I don't think it'll be too long before we start seeing
I think these people.
If they're smart, that's what they'll be doing.
Yeah, and also WP Chang, he says that if banks can lower the service charge, they would see sort of more take up, because consumers don't really see this yet, but to a vendor with a very small margin, this would eat into their profit.
Agreed. Right, we have to wrap up for this segment. I made a little bit of a boo-boo, you may have noticed. Our stinky story is up next after messages.
Yeah. I made a boo-boo. 50. Yeah. Oh, man.
Oh, here we go. I'm never going to hear the end of this. Ladies and gentlemen, let's take a music break. It is The Killers, For Reasons Unknown. We'll be right back after this. Don't go anywhere. You listen to BizBytes here on BFM 89.9.
Build financial mountains. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm in the studio with...
Jeff Sandhu.
I'm in your Raj.
Why are you laughing? What's going on?
No, nothing, nothing. I'm just enjoying what people are commenting about our questions that we're asking.
Okay, yeah. Just a reminder, if you can tell us how cashless you are and what you think about the cashless society moving forward, let us know. 018-789-8899 on WhatsApp, or get us on Twitter. We are at BFM Radio. Arvin has a stinky story now. He's been dying to tell us all about it.
Super stinky.
What is it about then? Come
on. So there's this company in Japan. Its name is Tanita. So they have just released a gadget that figures out how bad your body odor is.
Don't we have colleagues for that?
Yeah, we do, but not all of them are super accurate, you know.
Some of them are just too nice.
Just too nice.
Don't say anything. Just pretend and then go
just put up with it for years. Yeah, so the name of their gadget is the Tanita ES 100.
Oh, well, that's easy to remember.
Yeah, it is. So you just you turn it on, you flip out the sensor, then you point it to any part of your body that you're concerned about, and then it tells you.
You could be phrasing this so much better.
Yeah, no, you know? I'm just picking
he's phrasing
notes
this on a
on
purpose.
Yeah. So you point it, and then it tells you how intense your odor is on a 0 to 10 scale. So if it's 0, then you don't smell, and if it's 10, then you don't have friends. That's how the scale works. Anything above level 5 means that it's time for you to...
No, if you're a level 10, I guess you kind of just have to look around you and go like, huh, I think I'm a level 10 now.
There's a small cloud following you around. You
if
know.
if you walk into McDonald's and the queue just clears in front of you, then you're 10.
It's not magic, you stink.
So if it's anything above level 5, then the gadget tells you that you need to find like a deodorant or some kind of smell care, you need to do something. But it also works the other way around. So if you have too much deodorant,
it will also tell you.
Yeah, it also tells you. So it tells you that
great for teenage boys.
Yeah, it tells you that you have too much cologne or deodorant on, and then you need to tone down a bit and then bring it to like a moderate level and stuff. Yeah. So it costs $125.
Wow.
So that's about what? Times 3.9 in ringgit, and it's coming out next month.
All right.
No, wait. No, it's coming out this week.
It's coming out this week.
This week. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What's it called again?
The Tanita ES 100.
Tanita ES 100.
They're focusing on guys, salarymen in their 40s and 50s. because you're saying that these people are the ones.
Whoa.
Yes, so I know what to get for Christmas.
Yeah.
We can
we'll chip in.
You know what? I'm just going to turn your guys' mics off. Okay, good story though. Focusing on, I'm assuming, people traveling on the tube and everything over in Tokyo where it gets a bit warm, getting a little bit stinky.
Yeah, they actually have a word for it. It's called Sumeru Harasumento.
Uh-huh.
That means battling against bad odor.
That's two words.
One phrase.
Yeah. No, right. But it is true in European countries during summertime. Mm.
They're focusing on Tokyo. Don't point the finger at my European brethren. Bad experience.
They don't shower on a daily basis,
this
right?
So,
and for me, it's just like, you know, you wake up, you shower, and then you go for lunch, you shower again, you come back, you shower again, and before you go to sleep, you shower again. And then I realize, wow, they don't actually do this very often, and they just look at me weirdly, like, why are you going to the toilet all the time? Like, because I stay in the lodge, right? And
Right, we've got to wrap up. We're going to take a very short break. We've got some music from Manson with She Makes My Nose Bleed. That's up right now. When we get back, our final story, future fingerprint sensors will take your temperature to prove that you're human. This story sounds like it should be belonging to Matt Armitage, but I'm going to steal it from him before he does. Anyway, music, you are listening to Enterprise BizBytes on BFM 89.9.
Building First World Mindsets, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes. It's almost time for us to wrap up for the day. We've got about 5 minutes of talky time left, but final story. It's about in the future, fingerprint sensors will take your temperature to prove that you're human. You know, and not an android or AI or a lizard person or whatever it is that you want to, you know, decide on. So next generation smartphone fingerprint sensors could feature a temperature sensor for added security. A group of Samsung Display affiliated scientists have developed a solution that will sit under a display and offer the ability to measure pressure and temperature. So this was revealed in an article in Nature Communications via CNET, and it's a new sensor to improve security by guarding against forgeries. So the solution could prevent artificial fingerprints being used to prize open the smartphones, checking that the subject is human, right? The scientists from the Samsung Display UNIST Center in South Korea say the new tech even meets FBI security standards, whatever that means. It's called, they're calling it, transparent and flexible fingerprint sensor array with multiplex detection of tactile pressure and skin temperature.
Yeah, the name needs to be...
It needs a bit of work, right?
Yeah.
But it reads, in order to prevent the fingerprint forgery using artificial fingerprints, temperature of human finger skin can be detected using temperature sensors to distinguish real and counterfeit fingerprints, improving security levels further. We've had talks about, you know, how far are we from AI getting to the point where we cannot distinguish them from humans? We're quite a way away from that yet.
Yeah.
It seems as though these people behind Samsung, though, are kind of like, let's just kind of, you know, beat them at the curve kind of thing and sort it out early.
But I guess it's good though, because, you know, we are using fingerprints now for unlocking our phones and accessing our bank accounts.
Yep.
And it's kind of good that if there is a mechanism in place where the fingerprint can only be read if it's on a finger,
right?
Like a human finger.
Yes.
Not something where, you know, you manage to steal the data off the fingerprint data and then sort of clone it onto some sort of artificial skin, and then you kind of just use that instead. I don't know how fingerprints, like fake fingerprints, work, but I'm assuming that's how it is. But it would be nice if the system can detect if this is actually a real human finger,
right,
and not a real human finger.
Now you see the other benefits of this is things like you can use your phone's LED and torch. You can use it as a heart rate sensor.
Yes,
did you know that?
Yeah.
So this fingerprint sensor, it could be used if you've ever seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off. You know what he does? He pretends to be sick and puts his hand on the radiator, and you know his mum comes along. She checks his hand and his temperature, and she goes, "Oh, you're sick. Take the day off work." If I was that mother, I'd be like, right, put your finger on this little thing here. Let's find out, you know. But yeah, you could use it to find out whether or not you're feeling under the weather.
Kids in the future can't skip school.
They're not going to be able to skip school.
It's so hard for them. Yeah. I used to just put like a hot pack on my forehead and then, just...
Don't take this advice at home, ladies and gentlemen.
Just blow like hot air on your palm.
Horrible.
You guys are terrible. Yeah. Right, it's time for us to wrap up, but let's quickly run through what we covered on today's show. Of course, we did start off with Jeff's going cashless story.
Yeah, because Richard owes me 50 ringgit and we decided to talk about, you know, how cashless can we Malaysians actually go?
No, he owed you 50 ringgit. Now it's what, 70?
70. Hey, it goes up. Okay, yeah, it just goes up. Yeah,
I thought I was trustworthy enough to not have interest. And then, of course, we moved on to the story about how Uganda will be charging their citizens around 20 cents a day to use social media when they're using Cellcom data.
And in Kazakhstan.
Cell phone data.
Cell phone. And in Kazakhstan, they are actually throttling the internet when the president's rival is online.
Really?
Yeah.
That's surprising.
And then also, we had a chat with Shankar Kanibaran. He's the partner and the financial advisory services leader in Ernst & Young. And we just talked about the back end of banking.
Then we spoke about this device called Tanita ES100 that will tell you how much you stink.
Thanks.
Cool. Nice. I like how he looked at you as
I know,
well.
Right? Like, I saw that.
Radio was a lot more visual.
We need cameras in here, right? And final story, of course, was the story about the fingerprint sensors, how in the future, fingerprint sensors will be able to take your temperature to prove that you're human or sick. Right, but don't go anywhere. Coming up after the 1 o'clock news, it is, of course, the Breakfast Grill replay. The revenue group is set to list on the ACE market on July the 18th. It was Eddie Ung, the Managing Director and Group Chief Executive Officer for the revenue group. They're talking about IPO post-IPO growth strategies for the cashless payment solutions provider amid an increasingly competitive market. That's all coming up after the 1 o'clock news. Meanwhile, we've got some music to take us out of the break. It is the Arctic Monkeys with Fluorescent Adolescent. My name is Rich Bradbury. On behalf of Arvind Uvaraj and Jeff Sandu, this has been Enterprise Biz Bites on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.